Welcome to Heritage Wealth Advisors' fourth quarter 2019 market outlook conference call. All participants are in listen-only mode. There will be a Q&A session at the end of the prepared remarks. At that time, instructions will be given to ask a question. I will now turn the call over to your host, Jay Jordan, Heritage Wealth Advisors' Chief Investment Officer. Sir, you may begin.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our fourth quarter 2019 market outlook call. For those of you that would like to follow along, there is a slide deck that's available on our website that supports today's call, and we will reference it to every now and then. If you go to www.heritagewealth.net, you can click on the Resources tab in the top right corner, and then News and Updates, and then Investment Management, and you'll find our slides. There's also a replay of the call that will be available on the website after the call. I'm joined on the call today by two members of our investment team, Kerry Baronian, our manager of research, and Dennis Song. Our agenda this morning is to review recent market performance, discuss our current views with respect to the economy and capital markets, and provide insights into our current portfolio positioning. I'm going to begin by providing some high-level commentary on our views and then turn the call over to Kerry and Dennis to speak in more detail about our outlook and our current portfolio positioning. So after the sharp rebound across financial markets in the first half of the year, the third quarter represented a period of consolidation as easing financial conditions acted as a counterbalance against the continuing moderation in economic growth and challenging geopolitical headlines and trends. Equity returns were mixed, with U.S. large cap stocks up modestly, touching all-time highs during the quarter, while smaller stocks domestically and international stocks were down modestly. Fixed income returns were positive given the decline in interest rates, led by solid returns from preferred securities. Looking forward, we're weighing near-term risks to the equity market, including an election year that is likely to introduce heightened levels of volatility, with the potential for improving fundamental trends and valuations that appear reasonable relative to fixed income alternatives. So to go into more detail, I'm going to turn the call over to Kerry Baronian.
Thanks, Jay. As Jay mentioned, global bond yields have declined meaningfully this year as fixed income markets have been pricing in slower global growth, coupled with more accommodative monetary policy from central banks around the world. After reaching 3.25% last October, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.43% a few weeks ago, just shy of its all-time low. It's moved higher since then, finishing yesterday at 1.58%. If you're following along with the slides, you can see on page 3 that the yield on the 10-year has closely tracked the ISM Manufacturing Index, which is a measurement of expected manufacturing activity in the U.S. You can see that while accelerating growth pushed yields higher between mid-2016 and early 2018, weaker growth since then has pulled them back down. According to the September ISM reading, expected manufacturing activity has fallen to its lowest level in more than 10 years. Looking at the global landscape, the J.P. Morgan Global Manufacturing Purchasing Manager Index rose last month, but still resides at a level that signals weakening manufacturing activity. One bright spot of both reports was that manufacturers believe their customers are holding insufficient inventory. In other words, the pace of sales has been faster than the pace of production, resulting in lower inventory on hand. Ultimately, businesses will need to restock, which should support a rebound in manufacturing activity. Although difficult to time exactly, we believe that we may be nearing the bottom of this manufacturing cycle. If you're following along with the slides, you can see on page 4 that global economic activity has closely tracked global financial conditions. As we discussed in previous communications, global financial conditions have eased meaningfully this year as a result of falling bond yields, which history suggests should provide a tailwind to global growth over the next 6 to 9 months. If you're following along with the slides and are still on page 4, you can see that this dynamic is starting to play out, with global leading economic indicators recently turning upward. Despite weakness in the manufacturing sector, we believe that the U.S. economy remains on solid footing. According to its latest model, the Federal Reserve is forecasting real GDP growth of 1.8% for the third quarter. That's down from 2% growth in the second quarter, but positive nonetheless, and in line with the average pace of growth during this economic expansion. The ISM Non-Manufacturing Index, which is a measurement of services activity in the U.S., declined in September, but still resides at a level that is consistent with expanding activity. Additionally, the consumer, which represents about 70% of the total U.S. economy, continues to exhibit solid fundamentals. Real personal consumption spending is expected to grow 2.5% in the third quarter. That's down from 4.6% in the second quarter, but still a healthy rate. If you're following along with the slides, you can see on page 6 that average hourly earnings have been increasing, while the unemployment rate remains near a historically low level, both of which should help support consumer spending. You can also see that household net worth and the savings rate remain elevated, which should provide cushion against adverse shocks such as tariffs. Furthermore, the housing industry is gaining positive momentum, as evidenced by improving building permit, housing start, and home sales data. As we've discussed in previous communications, we initiated a tactical position in U.S. home construction stocks and client portfolios in early February based on a view that the housing industry should benefit from lower mortgage rates coupled with a favorable supply-demand picture. If you're following along with the slides, you can see on page 7 that residential investment has closely tracked mortgage rates while inventory and vacancy rates remain near historically low levels. We continue to hold the exposure to home builders and portfolios as we believe that the housing industry will continue to recover. Turning to international markets, the strength of the Chinese economy certainly has important implications for global growth. Although muted in comparison to their efforts in both 2008 and 2015, Chinese authorities have now implemented more than 100 acts of stimulus since the second half of last year to stabilize the economy. Given the lag between stimulus and the impact on the economy, these measures are just starting to result in improving data. For example, manufacturing purchasing manager indices came in higher than expected last month. Additionally, auto sales appear to have bottomed after declining by approximately 14% earlier this year. If you're following along with the slides, you can see on page 8 that global economic activity has closely tracked credit origination in China. History suggests recent credit growth in China should provide a tailwind to global growth. If you're following along with the slides and are still on page 8, you can see that European exports have also closely tracked credit origination in China. And history suggests recent credit growth should provide a tailwind to European exports. Europe has taken the brunt of slowing global growth as it's more reliant than other major economies such as the U.S. on manufacturing and trade. In the meantime, the European Central Bank has stepped in to support the economy by injecting liquidity. Euro area money growth, which leads real GDP growth, recently turned upward, while bank lending to the private sector has been increasing. With all of these considerations, we believe that the global economy is more likely to continue expanding in the near term, albeit modestly, than enter a recession. Monetary policy has become increasingly accommodative, with 46 central banks cutting short-term interest rates so far this year. As central banks typically are raising rates entering a recession and cutting them in the midst of one, we believe the current backdrop is inconsistent with the historical playbook for a meaningful economic downturn. The primary risk of injecting stimulus outside of a recession is the possibility of creating unwanted excess inflation. While inflation is a lagging indicator, inflation expectations remain below target in most economies. We therefore expect monetary policy to remain accommodative. With respect to fiscal policy, we expect existing stimulus in the U.S. to remain in effect, but we do not anticipate new initiatives in the near term. Congress is known for accomplishing less in presidential election years, and the impeachment inquiry seems to further reduce the likelihood of major law being passed. Overseas, China plans to step up stimulus, including increasing bond issuance to finance infrastructure projects, as well as cutting interest rate and reserve requirements. Additionally, other economies, such as France and India, have announced new policy that should be supportive of global growth. With that, I'll turn the call over to Dennis to discuss our outlook for financial markets and how we're positioning client portfolios.
Great. Thanks, Carrie. Appreciate you turning it over to me. If you're following along the slides, I'm on page 9. I think it makes sense to level set kind of where we've been in this last year in terms of equity markets before, diving into our positioning for our clients. Looking back in the last 12 months through yesterday, the S&P 500 is actually within 1.5% of the closing 12 months ago. So despite all the volatility we saw in the fourth quarter, and the subsequent rally in the early part of this year and kind of stalling out here in the third quarter, the markets are relatively flat. And in some ways, that's reflective of, the earnings growth. As we came into earlier this year, the markets were looking for mid to high single-digit earnings growth. As we're closing the year, I would say that most of the analysts have earnings growth in the flattish side, for 2019. So looking at page 9, on the left-hand side, what you have there is the 12 months forward-looking price-earnings ratio. And, obviously, where the red line depicts where the U.S. stands, which is roughly 17 times earnings, a slight premium relative to the global averages, clearly not as attractive as, they were back in 2009 and 2012, but certainly not at the height of the 2000s. We feel like this is in line with historical averages, and stocks, in our opinion, are fairly valued given current levels. On the right-hand side, what we're trying to depict here and show you is what the equity risk premium is in the market. And what the equity risk premium is basically the earnings yield over the 10-year Treasury risk-free rate. Essentially, what are you getting compensated for owning equities? And given where interest rates are, you can see that the equity risk premium is actually quite healthy. They're, again, not as attractive as they were in 2008, 2009, but given interest rates at 1.5%, 1.6% on the 10-year, the equity market continues to be a relatively attractive place to be, especially in relations to fixed income. So I think, it's helpful to kind of step back from the trees and look at the forest and see kind of where we are. And I think the key takeaway here is we continue to believe equities remain attractive on a relative basis based on historical basis as well as relative to fixed income. Okay. I did want to talk a little bit about, the risk that the potential risk that, to our base case, if you will. As you saw in the commentary, there are a host of factors that are probably worrying you and us, as frankly. And I'd like to start with the trade war, kind of what are our views and how are we adjusting portfolios to counter that. Clearly the trade wars are not helpful. I think it could be argued that if we're not in a trade war, the equity markets could be significantly higher. The trade wars with China in itself is not material relative to the rest of the U.S. economy. If you look at the amount of tariffs being imposed, we're talking, somewhere around $80 to $100 billion in the context of a $20 trillion economy. However, we are seeing the impact on confidence and how it's bled through the manufacturing sector, and it's starting to take some toll on the economy. But as Carrie said, we continue to believe the Federal Reserve's and the central banks across the world's accommodative actions is likely to stabilize growth and potentially see a reacceleration in the next 6 to 9 months. And with respect to the trade war itself, last week we saw some actions with the U.S. government talking about restricting potential investments in the Chinese companies in China. We've saw that the U.S. Trade Representative listed another 28 companies to be blacklisted. in terms of Chinese technology companies. And we saw that there was some removal of visas for diplomats related to the human rights abuses in China, in the Northwest China region. You know, on the other side, the Chinese government has, you know, taken actions against the National Basketball Association, restricting the preseason and the broadcast, and they've also scolded Apple for a particular app that they had allowed in Hong Kong. And I tell you all this details because I think it's important to see that the tit for tat is not helpful, and certainly makes a deal much tougher to reach in the short term. You know, one could argue that the Trump administration may actually prefer to have the trade war be an ongoing dispute into the elections as he continues to rally his base in the Rust Belt and showing that he is championing their cause. And then on the other hand, the Chinese leadership has been painted into a corner where if they were to agree to any type of deal, they would be perceived as losing, if you will. And with the changing of the administration, potential changing of the administration in the next year, it's highly unlikely that the Chinese would sign up to a multi-year deal that may be more punitive than the next administration, whoever that may be. So we think that both sides have dug in, and our base case is that this dispute continues on and off, you know, into the election year. I do believe, however, that both sides are going to continue to use communications as a tool to stabilize markets and confidence. You'll see that, you know, whenever the markets are in stress, we see the Trump administration march out various spokespersons and talks about the potential for a deal or progress to a deal. Talks resumed. And similarly, the Chinese leadership has undertaken similar actions. So from a position perspective in your portfolios, look, we continue to believe that China represents a tremendous long-term opportunity in terms of seeing the population moving, you know, the continued urbanization of the population and the tremendous consumerization that's happening there longer term. You know, short term, it is a challenge. In April, we re-entered emerging markets, which is roughly 50% China, with a 3-5% allocation. At that point, we thought that there was going to be more progress made on the trade front. We continue to monitor, and if we see a reacceleration in growth in emerging markets or a resolution to the trade dispute, we would potentially take that back up to a more equal weighting relative to the world index. Shifting gears to the political landscape, as Carrie and Jay talked about, you know, we do not expect a lot coming out of Washington this year in terms of legislative agenda, but we are cognizant of the potential headline risk associated with any political campaign. And when you're looking at the various investment sectors, the healthcare is the one that we've identified as one that's potentially at risk. So by way of background, at the end of the last election in early 2017, Heritage put on a tactical healthcare allocation of 2%, in the belief that, you know, the political campaign had taken its toll on the healthcare stocks, and that the risk-reward in the sector was rather attractive. After two strong years of performance, we've been systematically peeling back that exposure. We sold Gilead in early January. We felt like the company was not headed in the right direction that we were comfortable with, despite the healthy balance sheet. And then in April, we sold out of Amgen and bought Medtronic as a way to really shift our exposure in healthcare to medical devices away from pharmaceuticals, where the regulatory focus on pricing was going to be the greatest. And then in August, we closed out kind of the last piece of that healthcare exposure in Pfizer and Merck for those exact reasons as we continue to head towards the election. It's important to remember that we're not exiting healthcare altogether. We continue to hold United Healthcare and Johnson & Johnson, our concentrated leaders portfolio. We believe these are great franchises that will thrive again once the election cycle is over. I think it's important to keep in mind that there's the campaign rhetoric and then there's the realities of what could actually take place. The healthcare as a sector represents about 19% of the U.S. GDP. So to think a government, a complete government takeover of the sector, I think we could see what happens. But there's many stakeholders, let's put it this way, and there are many resources that's required to actually effectuate a fully run government healthcare. And just remember, under Obamacare, to expand and how much political capital was expended to just extend coverage to an incremental 20 million Americans in what we're trying to talk about in terms of a Medicare for all option. So we'll continue to monitor the situation, and we're being opportunistic, and as we see how the election plays out, we may implement additional positions there. And lastly, I'll just take another minute to discuss, how we're viewing the volatility with respect to interest rates and the flat yield curve. You know, how are we investing in this environment? As we discussed, we do see the economy picking up in the next 6 to 9 months. And along with that, unemployment rates, given where they are, we do think that there could be additional wage pressures, hence inflation and offing. So we have continued to manage our fixed income portfolios by staying shorter term and intermediate on the core fixed income, while try to supplement our fixed income portfolio by utilizing preferreds, i.e. taking more credit risk and a little bit less interest rate risk. And that's what we did in April when we shifted additional capital to the preferred securities market. And then lastly, I would just touch on the concentrated leaders portfolio, the changes we made. We added Progressive Insurance to the concentrated leaders portfolio, a great franchise that's got an 8 to 9% market share with significant runway to continue to penetrate the direct-to-consumer auto and commercial lines. They've got a great model that we believe will continue to allow them to grow revenues in the high single digits and underwrite business at a profitable rate. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jay for any closing comments.
Great. Thanks, Dennis. So to wrap up, our expectation for a continuation of this economic cycle is still being weighed against the likelihood for increased volatility over the course of the next year as we consider portfolio allocations. Equity markets do continue to hold favorable valuation characteristics relative to fixed income over the long term, but we are reviewing each client's individual situation to ensure we have appropriate liquidity to manage and take advantage, honestly, of any volatility. At the same time, we continue to look for alternative investments to add income, given the low level of interest rates around the world. So with that, that's going to conclude our prepared remarks. We're now going to turn it over to the operator for Q&A.
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star, then one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Again, it is star, then one to register to ask a question. We'll pause to allow questions to queue.
And maybe while we're waiting, I'm going to ask Dennis to address one question that's been asked over the last couple weeks and really over the last few months, which is specifically, how should we be viewing the reality of negative interest rates globally and the prospect of negative interest rates domestically at some point in the future?
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Yeah, this has been a very topical topic the last couple of weeks, given the persistent negative interest rates in Europe and Japan that you're hearing about. Let's look at the circumstances in which negative rates really come about. You have in both of those situations extremely weak economic growth in a deflationary environment. And, you know, let's translate it to what we're seeing here in the U.S. You know, while, as we discussed, you know, the U.S. economy is weakening, but we continue to believe that we're not going to enter a recession. And inflation in the U.S. continues to run just below 2%. So we're not really close to a deflationary environment. And Federal Reserve Chairman Powell actually addressed this topic a couple weeks ago and said that, you know, the Fed studied potentially using negative interest rates during a financial crisis, but they elected not to use it. And the reason they did that was in looking at past instances of negative rates, it's questionable how effective it really is. And the biggest casualty of negative interest rates is actually on, you know, the banks themselves. Because outside of Norway, we're one of the Norway countries where you're actually getting a negative mortgage, consumers actually still do not get the negative rates. There's still a spread onto, you know, traditional benchmark rates. The people that are hurt the most, frankly, is the banks that have to keep reserves with the central banks. And so all you're really doing is really weakening the bank's balance sheet in a negative interest rate environment. So the Fed has talked about it being committed not to use negative rates. And there are other tools in their toolbox to fight a potential recession. So obviously they were not able to normalize rates as much as they like this year. They, you know, this past cycle, they got the Fed funds up to 2.25, 2.5%. Traditionally, in a recession scenario, they've been able to ease upwards of 500 basis points. But what the other two tools that they could use, frankly, is a forward guidance. You know, being very aggressive and explicit in how long they would potentially keep rates low. And they did this back in 2011 to 2015 when they continued to extend the patience and the foreseeable future language that they utilize around rates. And that was able to, you know, basically stabilize the rate market at a relatively low level. And then lastly, they could always use quantitative easing and target particular maturities and try to steepen the yield curve, if that's what they're trying to do, by buying treasuries and mortgage-backed rates. So, you know, to kind of bring it all together, you know, there are still tools that the Fed could use. That's not to say that it could never happen, because who knows what the future holds. But, you know, in that particular environment, you know, we continue to like, if you are headed to more negative rates, obviously cash flow, businesses and investments and securities such as preferreds and dividend paying stocks.
All right, operator, do we have any questions?
We do have a question. It comes from James. Your line is open.
Jay and Dennis, thank you for talking about the negative interest rates. I appreciate those comments. My comment to Dennis, I guess, is about sector allocation. You indicated that you're de-emphasizing healthcare, but I didn't hear you indicate that you were overweighting another sector category, and I was just curious if you had one that you thought was particularly attractive at this time.
Sure. I'll start, and Jay, please jump in. You know, when we look at how we've constructed our portfolios, as you may recall, Jim, in September of 18, we shifted to an equal weight S&P 500 core exposure, and that by default gave you additional exposures into industrials, real estate, utilities, some financials. So we are slightly overweight those particular sectors. And that is, you know, they've not been the best performance, frankly, year to date, but we really like the risk-reward profile in, you know, with some of those cyclical and more rate-sensitive areas. And it just goes back to our thesis that if we believe the stabilization of the economy by the various central banks, and particularly the Fed, and that we see a potential reacceleration in the economy, the risk reward in those sectors actually are pretty attractive.
Right, and I, you know, Jim, maybe to expand on that a little bit, if you look at the market itself, there's a pretty large dichotomy in valuation between some of your more growthy areas of the market and some of the areas of the market that have a little bit more sensitivity to the economy. And that was really part of the basis, if you recall, to the shift we made back in September of last year towards the equal weighted index was based in, you know, pretty dramatic differences in valuation. If you look at a traditional value portfolio as an example, it's currently selling at about 11 to 12 times earnings versus multiples for growth businesses that are, you know, higher than the 17, 18 times that we quoted earlier. You know, the other thing that I would point out is, you know, when we took the healthcare weighting down, we brought it back to a neutral weighting within portfolios. So that was an overweighting that we had implemented in portfolios back in January of 2017 based on what we thought was particularly attractive valuations relative to our expectations for earnings growth. We're now at a place where we'd like to be, we wanted to pull the portfolio back towards neutral.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star, then one on your touchtone phone. We'll pause for any additional questions to queue. Again, that is star, then one. At this time, there are no additional phone questions.
Okay. Well, thank everybody for taking the time to join us this morning. A copy of the call will be available on the website along with the slides. You know, in the meantime, please don't hesitate to reach out with any additional questions to Carrie, Dennis, me, or any other member of the team at Heritage. So I hope everybody has a great day.